Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the contentious intelligence briefings that took place last week, which left Democratic members of the House of Representatives fuming at FBI Director Comey for apparently stonewalling on investigating Russian connections to the Trump campaign, while being all too eager to release unverified and damaging information about Hillary Clinton, which she claims lost her the election. Nick Ackerman, a former federal prosecutor and assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, as well as an assistant special Watergate prosecutor, joins us to discuss whether James Comey is intensely partisan or spectacularly incompetent, since members of Congress leaving the intelligence briefing accused him of having no credibility, of being condescending and arrogant, while the ex-MI6 intelligence officer responsible for the explosive dossier on Trump was frustrated by the lack of response from Comey, who apparently sat on his dossier, a digest of which was recently presented to the president and the president-elect in a major intelligence briefing on Russian meddling in our recent election. Then we'll look into the lack of solidarity shown by the White House press corps, who submissively sat by while President-elect Trump refused to let a journalist ask a question while accusing CNN of broadcasting fake news. Jeff Jarvis, a professor and director of the Tonight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism, joins us to discuss how the press has allowed Trump to establish a standard where he decides which questions to answer and which news outlets he favors, and the similarities between the incoming Trump administration's treatment of journalists and how Vladimir Putin and other authoritarian regimes manage their press. Then, finally, we will speak with James Kloppenberg, professor of American history at Harvard University and the author of Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition, and his latest book, Towards Democracy, the Struggle for Self-Rule in European and American Thought. We'll discuss Obama's legacy and his recent farewell address and assess his successes and failures, given that Obama has a deep commitment to bipartisanship, yet during his terms in office, the country became much more polarized. And joining us now is Nick Ackerman, who served as a federal prosecutor and was an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York, as well as an assistant special Watergate prosecutor, a nationally recognized expert on computer crime and the protection of sensitive information. He is now a partner at the international law firm of Dorsey & Whitney. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nick Ackerman.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Nick. And what do you make of this very contentious hearing that the House conducted last Friday left many members fuming? Our local congresswoman here, Maxine Waters, said the FBI director has no credibility. My confidence in the FBI director's ability to lead this agency has been shaken, said Representative Hank Johnson of Georgia, and so forth. We don't know what went on in this classified briefing, but the impression that we've been given by these fuming members of Congress is that he'd been stonewalling on the Russian investigation, or the investigation of Russian hacking of the recent elections, and the double standard, which is apparent, where he was all too eager to release an unverified report on Hillary Clinton's connection to this disgraced congressman and his wife, their emails, and that, of course, she blames that for costing her the election. So I'd say on the surface, there is a extraordinary double standard if indeed Comey has been stonewalling the Russian investigation.
Yeah, it's not just the Russian investigation. I mean, there's been a double standard throughout this entire matter, throughout the election. I mean, Comey said the other day that he had no right to comment or would not comment on an ongoing investigation with respect to the Russians. But it's not just the Russians. If you recall, Governor Chris Christie was a candidate for president this last time. And it's also obvious now that he was under investigation at the time with respect to the George Washington Bridge scandal. And you certainly didn't see Director Comey coming out and giving any information or updates on that scandal. He also didn't give any updates on any other investigation into Donald Trump, despite the myriad of crimes that came out during the course of this campaign, including the Trump University fraud, probably a fraud on investors and security holders in the various construction projects that Trump had in Atlantic City. There is no question that there is a double standard. You have to even ask yourself, why was it that this whole matter relating to Hillary Clinton's emails were investigated by the FBI in the first place? I mean, all you really had was somebody using another server, a private server, which is not a crime. So even reaching out and investigating her in the first place was somewhat of a, you know, a far reach for the FBI when there was no basis to believe that any crime had been committed.
Well, indeed. And that server, by the way, was under the control of the Secret Service because President Clinton, it was at his house. So she, of course, never made a good case for that it was a non-news story. And by the way, the existence of the server story was first broken by RT, Russia Today, based upon a hacking of Sid Blumenthal's emails, which revealed his communications with this server.
And the irony is, of course, that server was probably better protected than the one used by the DNC or by the State Department, both of which have been hacked during the course of the election.
Well, but there is also a sort of strange double standard in our politics on both on the right and on the left. You have a peculiar symmetry where people are making excuses for Putin and suggesting that anybody that's critical of Russia's role in meddling in our elections is trying to reignite a new Cold War. What do you make of that peculiar? I don't know whether I'm experiencing it here because I'm with a left wing radio network, and so I'm getting a lot of abuse for simply trying to cover this story, which seems pretty real to me that Putin did it, and even Trump finally was forced to admit that the Russians did hack the elections.
And not only hack the election, but they did it in order to favor Hillary Clinton. This just wasn't a normal
hack. You mean to favor Donald Trump?
I'd favor Donald Trump, yeah. I mean, he was able, Putin and his hackers were able to get into the Republican National Committee server, and they were able to hack into that. But interestingly enough, the only thing that came out that they let be released through WikiLeaks was the material that they hacked out of the DNC. There's no question that there's a double standard here. And I think the real question that people have to ask, is this all because Comey, one, either has bad judgment, it's one of two things, either he has terrible judgment, or he was purposely and has been purposely creating this double standard in order to help elect Trump.
And again, I'm speaking with Nick Ackerman, who served as a federal prosecutor and was an assistant U.S. United States attorney in the Southern District of New York, as well as an assistant special Watergate prosecutor. Now, what's your understanding, since you were with the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, obviously had a lot of dealings with the FBI, the excuse that one hears for Comey's actions vis-a-vis the Hillary Clinton letter that she claims cost her the elections was that the FBI office of the New York office of the FBI was about to leak this information about an investigation into the emails of the disgraced Congressman Wiener and his wife who worked for Hillary Clinton, and that this is all being pushed by Rudolph Giuliani, and that Comey had to get out ahead of this leak to maintain his own credibility.
Well, I've never heard of anybody getting out ahead of a leak by leaking it yourself. I mean, you don't do something illegal to prevent something illegal from happening. He's the director of the FBI. He's supposed to be managing the FBI. If he had thought that somebody was leaking, he should have been disciplining that person immediately, should have stopped anybody from leaking any kind of information. To excuse it by saying, oh, there was going to be a leak anyway, kind of just underscores his own incompetence or his evil intent to have this come out.
Well, obviously, the Democrats on the committees, it was an intelligence briefing right across the board. Anybody that was cleared could go in. And I believe that this intelligence briefing, or the fact that it was so contentious and that Comey stonewalled and wouldn't say anything about an ongoing investigation into Russian hacking, even though he's apparently sat on this report, this dossier that the former MI6 officer Christopher Steele compiled initially for opposition research for Republicans and then for Democrats. And then he got it to both the FBI's office in Rome. He also got it to John McCain, who then gave it to Comey. And apparently Christopher Steele, the MI6 officer, was so frustrated that he wasn't getting any response from the FBI that he came over here on his own dime and met with David Korn of Mother Jones to try and push the story. So what's your take on whether Comey, why would he be stonewalling this stuff? And eventually a digest of this did appear in the briefings that both President-elect and President Obama got the end of last week, I think it was.
The only justification he would have for not releasing this publicly was that they could not confirm what was in that dossier. They could not find evidence to support it. But that's totally contrary to what he did with Hillary Clinton. He had no trouble in July getting out there and speculating about whether or not she used classified information, whether she had it on her server, total speculation, speculating about whether or not she was careless with classified information. I mean, again, a double standard. If you're going to be putting that kind of stuff out there for the public, you've got to ask yourself, why wasn't he putting out this other, what would be unsubstantiated and speculative information about Trump, which I must say rings a lot more true than anything that he said about Hillary Clinton.
Well, it's clear that the frustration felt by members of Congress, or Democrats, the Republicans have not said anything about it, but about the briefing. But clearly, there were a lot of angry Democrats leaving that briefing last Friday. And of course, it probably prompted Representative John Lewis of Georgia to in an interview for Meet the Press on NBC, said, "I don't see the president-elect as a legitimate president. I think the Russians participate in helping this man get elected, and they help destroy the candidacy of Hillary Clinton." Now, that remark, of course, has created a tremendous firestorm. And, you know, again, you know, people get all up in arms. The press are all huffing and puffing about it. What a terrible thing that BuzzFeed released this information. This is the same press that were all too eager to print anything that WikiLeaks leaked on Hillary Clinton, in spite of the fact that there were suspicions that the material came from Russian intelligence. So that's kind of ridiculous. I mean, the information's information. It can be put out. It should be put out. That's the role of the press.
Well, even more so, what's really significant here is if it's true, and I must say, if you take the allegations about the women in Moscow, you compare it to the sort of hard information that came out during the campaign about him offering $10,000 to an actress in a X-rated film to basically visit him in his hotel room. You put all that stuff together, and what you realize is if this is true, it means that the Russians have a significant hammer over our next president, that he knows if he does anything contrary to the Russians, they've got information that they can immediately put out there that can totally destroy him. So in a way, by not putting this information out, Russia is in a stronger position knowing that they know and Trump knows what it is they've got.
Well, I was just to follow up though on this, you know, sort of phony indignation about the BuzzFeed leak that a lot of members of the press are carrying on about. And, you know, information's information. You're supposed to get stuff out. And you can certainly qualify it by saying it's it's unverified, and perhaps they should have done that, but so what? I mean, at the end of the day, it's real information, and it was certainly information that ended up in a high-level intelligence briefing that was briefed to both President Obama and President-elect Trump. But the same response seems to be for Representative John Lewis's remark that I don't see the president-elect as a legitimate president. You know, you can have two thoughts in your head at the same time. Trump may not be a legitimate president, but he is the president. So, you know, what are they going on about? I mean,
no. And look at the fact of that dossier and that piece that BuzzFeed printed is extremely important just for the reasons I said.
Yeah.
If, in fact, there is any truth to it, it really calls into question almost every move that Trump may make relating to Russia. People have to ask themselves, you know, is this being done because it's something that's in the best interest of the United States, or is it being done because Donald Trump doesn't want the truth to come out about what the Russians have on him?
Well, there is an Inspector General's report underway at the Justice Department on Comey's handling of it. But, of course, it could be worse. You know, Donald Trump could appoint Rudy Giuliani to head up the CIA, to head up the FBI.
Well, it could be, but it can't be much worse than it is right now. I mean, the fact that, you know, just to understand how the FBI works, I mean, they are simply the investigative arm of the Department of Justice. Their only job is to go out and investigate facts, determine what the facts are, and it's up to the prosecutors to determine whether or not the information that's gathered in those facts actually constitutes a federal crime worthy of prosecution. It's not the job of the FBI director to go out making statements about the status of an investigation, to comment on a particular subject of an investigation, to comment on the evidence. Not even J. Edgar Hoover did that. I mean, what Comey did was just absolutely wrong, and he had no business doing it. If the attorney general did it, she would have had no business doing it. And the only time anybody in the Department of Justice ever makes comments on the evidence or a case is simply when there's an indictment, and even then, they're limited to what the indictment says.
Well, Nick Ackerman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Nick Ackerman, who served as a federal prosecutor and was an assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, as well as an assistant special Watergate prosecutor. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the lack of solidarity shown by the White House press corps, who submissively sat by while President-elect Trump refused to let a journalist ask a question while accusing CNN of broadcasting fake news.
Beware of pretty faces that you find. A pretty face can hide an evil mind. Oh, be careful what you say, or you give yourself away. Odds are you won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Asian man, secret.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jeff Jarvis, a professor and director of the Tone Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism, a national leader in the development of online news blogging and the investigation of news business models for news and the teaching of entrepreneurial journalism. He writes the influential blog BuzzMachine.com and is the author of What Would Google Do? And Public Parts, How Sharing in the Digital Age Improves the Way We Work and Live, as well as the ebook Gutenberg the Geek. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Jarvis.
Thanks much.
And the press conference that Donald Trump held last Wednesday was unusual, to put it mildly.
What has he done that has not been unusual?
I know.
Go ahead.
So, well, to that extent, I think you can expect it. But having a cheer squad on the side, etc. And then, but the most important part of it, to my mind, was when he attacked the CNN journalist and refused to allow him to ask a question, and he accused CNN of fake news for publishing a story that was a legitimate story, which was that the intelligence services briefed both the president and the president-elect on this dossier that was out there. They didn't print the dossier, as did BuzzFeed, but they referred to the intelligence briefing, which is actual news. So my sense is that that was a terrible moment for the American press. If there was any solidarity in the American press, and in particularly in the White House press corps, they would have all got up and left and walked out in solidarity for Jim Sciutto, the guy that Trump was berating and his cheer squad on the side were booing, and whose question he refused to answer. Because from now on, Trump has set the bar. He doesn't have to answer questions if he doesn't like them, and he doesn't have to talk to reporters from news organizations that he thinks are either fake news or a disgusting pile of garbage.
Right, so I agree. Is there honor among thieves when the thieves are journalists? I don't know. What should have happened is that every journalist there should have said, no, answer his question first. And or walked out. But you had people there from the likes of Breitbart, and they're not going to play along, and it only takes one to ruin the game. We have worse news today that they're now threatening to move the White House press room out of the White House, so there'd be no way to hang around with people. A few thoughts on this. One is that I don't think that we should continue to make the game of journalism a game of access. And I'm not sure that there's going to be a lot of value to go to these press briefings, which you can watch on TV anyway, or to sit in the press room and hear them. You can watch them on C-SPAN. I talked to a journalist in Argentina, and there are journalists in other countries, certainly Russia and other countries, that have had to cover authoritarian regimes. And I asked this journalist in Argentina what to expect. And she said, well, first, expect no access. Second, expect to be attacked. Those prophecies have certainly just come to light. And third, she said, the only thing you can do then is investigate, investigate, investigate. And I think given how little we know about Trump's business dealings still, about his ties to Russia, about lots of things about him, his family businesses, I think that it's better to not spend time in the official press briefings and to spend time instead doing a few things. One is reporting on him, investigating him. That's what journalism is supposed to do. And two, perhaps even more importantly, to go listen to the people across the country and understand what their real concerns and real needs are so that we as journalists can help meet those needs. I think if there's any great lesson from this election, it's that we in journalism didn't pay attention to half of the country and they in turn didn't pay attention to us.
Well, to that extent, the people that voted for Donald Trump probably thought the press conference was wonderful, if they even bothered to watch it, and they loved what he did, and they love his sort of macho kind of toughness, and it plays very well. But when you mentioned, Jeff Jarvis, how foreign journalists see it, there's a very, very interesting article by Alexei Kovalev, a Russian journalist, A Message to My Doomed Colleagues in the American Media, where he says, you know, congratulations, U.S. media. You've just covered your first press conference of an authoritarian leader with a massive ego and a deep disdain for your trade and everything you hold dear. We in Russia have been doing it for 12 years now. So it's a very powerful article. And it felt to me when I read that this is sort of, can you shame our press into standing up for their trade?
I wish we could. I think I've been thinking about that, and the journalism school is kind of an independent third party. We've been thinking about that as well. How do we pull together the profession to see what we stand for, what we stand together on? And I think that we should say that we're going to stand together as responsible journalists. And that means a few things. One, it means that if somebody gets abused, for no reason, as occurred in the CNN case, we stand by them, and we write editorials and say things at the press conference and say we won't accept this kind of behavior. Second is, I think that the Panama Papers case recently, investigative journalism that was done from the Süddeutsche Zeitung and then many other outlets, demonstrates how journalists can collaborate together on difficult stories, especially as we have lost more and more staff and resources and face more difficulty. And I think we have to collaborate more and more. So, you know, you look at something like David Farenthold's work at the Washington Post when he was covering Trump's charitable donations or lack thereof. He went and crowdsourced with the public and asked for their help. And the public did some pretty amazing things. We should be doing the same as journalists and journalists, and not trying to get the scoop, but trying to advance the story and advance our knowledge. So I think as journalists, we can behave differently than we did. Is that possible culturally? I don't know. I think, you know, somebody like a university has to bring people together and say, how can we change our ways?
And again, I'm speaking with Jeff Jarvis, who's a professor and director of the Tonight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. So you just mentioned a minute ago, Jeff Jarvis, that what the journalists should have done when Trump attacked Jim Shooter of CNN and refused to answer his questions and called CNN fake news, that the rest of the journalists should have insisted that Trump answer his question before proceeding, and that they didn't show that solidarity. But if they had shown that solidarity, Breitbart News and perhaps Fox and others, although I must say that Shepard Smith did call out this incident and express solidarity for Jim Shooter of CNN. So, but the point is, if that would have happened, wouldn't that have just isolated Breitbart News and Fox as the Pravda of the White House?
Well, indeed, but it shows that's who Trump will talk to and won't talk to the others. I mean, Shooter did not even have a chance to ask the question, let alone get it answered. So I think we've got to have some kind of conversation to know how we behave. My friend Jay Rosen, who's a journalism professor at New York University, who's a brilliant guy, has been writing about how the rules that we have and how journalism is operated with presidents and politics are all out the window. Trump has thrown every rule out the window, so we've got to rethink how we operate. We've got to be much more creative in how we operate. We've got to know what we do in these circumstances, which, again, we know are coming. All we have to do is ask journalists who covered authoritarian regimes elsewhere in the world, and they have the playbook, and they can exactly tell us what's going to happen, and it's happening to us. So what are we doing? We're still bringing our old tricks to a new game.
Well, the other thing that's happened is that it looks as though Stephen Bannon, you know, the chief strategist, has actually understood where people get their news from, more than Hillary Clinton did. And he's on the board of Cambridge Analytics. They did data mining of Facebook and social media for the Brexit vote, which they won, almost like a rehearsal for the Trump campaign. And it was the Republicans who went after Zuckerberg and Facebook and intimidated them into getting rid of the human curation on the canard that Facebook's news choices were too liberal. Then they switched, Facebook switched to algorithms, and then immediately the fake news emerged, and more people got fake news and less real news. And that's all being documented by a number of studies. And when you look at the main purveyor of fake news, this is talk about the pot calling the kettle black. It was Donald Trump who accused CNN of fake news.
Amen.
This is the man, I'll just go through a list, said that Obama is a Kenyan and a Muslim who never attended Columbia University. Then the fake news came out that Hillary Clinton was too ill to serve as president. That was, again, through Bannon, it seems, and through Facebook. Ted Cruz's father was involved in a plot to kill President Kennedy. The Central Park Five are guilty, deserve the death penalty. He reiterated it even after the DNA cleared them. Thousands and thousands of Muslims were cheering on 9/11. The Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia was murdered, and so forth. I mean, I could go through a whole list of fake news that became very much a part of, and of course, climate change is a trick pulled on us by the Chinese. Vaccines cause autism. He just had a prominent...
The list just never ends, does it?
Right, but he had Trump Tower the other day, he had the one scientist in the world that has some wacky theory about climate change, CO2 being good for the planet. And of course, he had Bobby Kennedy Jr. show up to talk about vaccines causing autism. Now, Trump's son, Barron, apparently has autism or Asperger's. I understand, that may be a personal connection there, but still, this is the man who, more than anybody on this planet, has been a purveyor of fake news.
Yeah, it comes from the top now. But I'm going to come back to us in media. I think that we left all these tricks of the trade to not only Trump and the Trumpists, but also to the fake news factories, that some of which were doing it for political purposes, for economic reasons, not political purposes. And we in media still insisted on saying to people, oh, no, no, the way to get informed is to click and come to our sites and read our 1,000-word articles. The social tokens that people were passing around as memes with lies in them, we didn't give people truth memes. We should recognize how people use news today. And it's not just about consuming content. Facebook and Twitter are places where people have conversations. And what we really want to do is to help inform those conversations. Now, I think there's been a lot of good movement on this fake news issue with Facebook, which isn't the only body responsible here. But Facebook is doing, I think, the right thing, they're not trying to kill the lies and the fake news, because that's whack-a-mole. You can't do that. It'll never succeed. Instead, what they're trying to do is give people more information at the critical moments when they're choosing whether or not to click and read or to share. And they're using outside help in the form of fact-checkers to do that. I think that's wonderful. We in media should be doing a lot more in terms of giving people truth bullets they can fire as part of their conversations. We've got to recognize how much this world is changing, and we can't continue to argue whether we're reporting from the White House press room or whether we're writing our stories in old newspapers. It's a new world, and we've got to update ourselves.
But Jeff Jarvis, Zuckerberg, as I mentioned, was intimidated by the Republicans, and I believe it came from Bannon, into rolling over for that fake canard that there's a liberal bias, got rid of the human curation, went to algorithms, and now recognizes the problem of fake news. And guess who he's put in charge of news now at Facebook? Campbell Brown, close friend of Betsy DeVos's, taken a lot of money from Betsy DeVos, the new nominee for the Department of Education. She's married to Dan Senior, a former White House official under George W. Bush. You know, I'm not suggesting that he's not entitled to hire conservatives, but he certainly swung the pendulum back right in that direction. These are all people very friendly to the Trump regime.
Well, there's various issues there. I think that where those human editors were used was in the trending feature on Facebook, just there. It wasn't in your news feed. It was in that. And frankly, the trending feature, I think, is awful. They should just get rid of it. It's an attempt to just give people things they wouldn't otherwise read. And, if you want trending, go to Twitter. It's fairly ridiculous. I think there's other ways that Facebook could show you things that you don't see. I think there's other things they could do. In terms of the hires, after that kerfuffle about the editors and trending, Zuckerberg did invite in conservatives into Facebook. And on its face, I don't argue with that. I think that we in media, and mind you, I'm liberal and I'm media, but I think that we abandoned the right half of America. They don't trust us, and thus they wouldn't listen to us. We didn't have the opportunity to inform their worldview. So I oddly think that one thing we need in American media is to invest in responsible, fact-based, journalistic, conservative media. I'm in Europe right now, and I come to Germany, where I am now, and there are robust national media brands from reasonable left and reasonable right, and you can triangulate. We don't really have that in America. So reaching out to responsible conservative voices is not a bad thing in and of itself. Being cowed into saluting the flag of one side over the other, that's not so good. So I think we have to see how this plays out over time and see how Facebook responds.
But so much of the criticism that BuzzFeed has gotten for publishing this dossier that had been floating around the press for a long time and nobody had been able to verify it because it comes from both opposition research and comes out of an intelligence officer from MI6, and it is written as an intelligence report, not as a piece of journalism. First of all this huffing and puffing about how terrible BuzzFeed is, whether or not that's going to kill the story or not, I don't know. But, this is the same press that was only too willing to print everything that WikiLeaks dumped.
Amen.
So what's all this self-righteousness about?
Yeah. Well, we're good at self-righteousness in journalism, aren't we? I found it very interesting that there has been a fairly firm split among those who write about journalistic ethics about BuzzFeed's decision to print the dossier. Margaret Sullivan, who's the ombudsman at the Washington Post, whom I respect greatly, thought it was wrong. Others thought it was wrong, but many thought it was right. I fall in the latter category. I think that once this document was in the national discussion, we, the citizens, have some measure of right to know what it is. And I think that more than that, we've got to change, again, our attitude about how the world operates right now. We're no longer the gatekeepers. Things will get out without us. If we think that the country is too stupid to know what to do with it, well, then our job is to make the country smarter. We should be adding context. We should be explaining where things come from. If you look at, let's say, Vox did a very good job, I think, of adding context to the dossier, explaining what it is and how it's written. I think CNN did a good job of explaining where it came from and was very precise about its limits. That's the job we've got to take on now. We have to add information, add value to a flow of information that can now occur without us, whether that's WikiLeaks leaks or leaks from other mechanisms. Information's going to get out more and more and more, and we can't act as if, well, if we don't report it, the world doesn't know it. We have to instead say, well, we know this is out there, it's being discussed, and this is what you should know about it. This is what we can confirm. In the end of the day, journalism has to become best at saying not what we know, but what we don't know.
Well, but you mentioned that the White House is now thinking about maybe even shutting down the press room. And there's no question that Trump has established a new rule, which is he can decide what questions he answers and from which news organization. If he doesn't like the reporter or the news organization, he can call them fake and a pile of garbage and insult them. So that's one part of what's going on here. But just as President Obama leaves his office in his farewell address, let me just quote a little bit. Politics is a battle of ideas. In the course of a healthy debate, we prioritize different goals and the different means of reaching them. But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent is making a fair point and that science and reason matter, we'll keep talking past each other, making common ground and compromise impossible. What do you think of that warning?
One more reason to regret we're losing that president who can articulate such things so well. It's absolutely true. But I also think that if you look at the trust numbers for media, they're record lows. We have to rethink how we do the job. You know, I don't want to be too provocative when I say this, but I think that if it's our job to inform the public, the results of this election are a demonstration that we failed at that. And I don't just mean that as an insult to Trump voters. What I mean instead is that the quality and intelligence of civic discourse in this election was abhorrent, and it demonstrates that we didn't inform it. So there are those who tell me when I say this, oh, well, but people don't care about the facts. I refuse to believe that. Some don't, of course, but I can't believe that people want to be wrong, that they want to be ill-informed, but we've got to find better ways to gain their trust. And part of that is also to start not by speaking to them, but by listening to them, by having some measure of empathy with their state of the world. And then maybe you can have a discussion with unemployed factory workers and say, you know, your problem is not immigration. Your problem is technology. And here's what you have to do about that to get a job back. It's not going to come at 100 jobs here and 100 jobs there negotiated by Donald Trump. That's a conversation we can't have very well right now. We've got to figure out how to have that conversation so that we can, again, have a fact-based discussion about issues in this country, because right now it's only emotionally based.
Well, Jeff Jarvis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Jarvis, who's a professor and director of the Tone Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. He's a national leader in the development of online news blogging, the investigation of news business models for news, and the teaching of entrepreneurial journalism. And he writes the influential blog BuzzMachine.com. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing President Obama's legacy and his recent farewell address.
and all of its strength in decline. It suffered all of its strength in the fall. Sometimes when he got into fighting, man, he could fight with you all day long. He was a good man, and now he's gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Kloppenberg, who is the Charles Warren Professor of American History and the Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. His books include Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. And his latest book is Towards Democracy, The Struggle for Self-Rule in European and American Thought. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Kloppenberg.
Pleasure to be with you.
And it does seem in many ways a tragic irony that President Obama, who I understand is deeply committed to bipartisanship and has been for the longest time, and in his famous speech to the Democratic Convention in, was it back in 84, where he was first... 2004, when he was first introduced to the nation, if you will, talked about there's no red and blue America. So I think it's something that's deeply ingrained in him. And yet during his terms in office, the country has become much more polarized. So how does that strike you?
Well, I think he put his finger on it in the farewell address just the other night, that part of what has happened is that the underlying commitment that Americans have to the processes of democracy is less stable than it has been maybe at any point in our history other than during the Civil War. And I think the Republican Party's decision very early in his first term to oppose absolutely everything he proposed was unprecedented in American history. And there has been partisanship, there has been a degree of strident opposition, but never as strident or as far-reaching as it has been during his presidency. And it'll take a long time before we're able to figure out how much of that has to do with his programs and how much of it has to do with his person, the fact that he was the first mixed-race African and American president elected in the United States. But both of those clearly had something to do with it, and it's very hard to know how much of it has to do with the transformation of the press, how much of it has to do with the intransigence of racism in America, and how much of it has to do with the continuing opposition that many Americans feel to programs of social democratic and cultural change of the sort that he championed.
So in terms, though, of his Obama's apparent deep commitment to bipartisanship, I understand from conversations with your colleague there at Harvard, Robert Putnam, who puts on the Sequoia seminars, when Obama was at Harvard, that he really enjoyed these seminars that go on for over the weekend, where you have, for example, the head of a union breaking bread with the head of the Christian Coalition. Is that your understanding, that this is something that's deeply ingrained in Obama?
I think so. I think it goes right down to the core of his being, which is part of what makes the column that Eric Cantor wrote in the New York Times this morning laughable. He contends that Obama stopped being interested in bipartisanship almost the moment he became president, and I think the record simply doesn't sustain that. It's very important for the Republicans to make that argument, but I think he tried to meet them more than halfway on almost every initiative that he offered, and the Affordable Care Package is exactly what Mitt Romney had campaigned on in Massachusetts and put in place when he was governor of Massachusetts. This is hardly a radical single-payer plan of the sort that many people in the Democratic Party wanted. And the same thing is true, I think, throughout Obama's presidency, that he tried very hard to find grounds for a bipartisan approach to many of the problems facing the United States, but he was rebuffed at every step. Part of my argument in reading Obama was that this commitment to finding solutions that were satisfactory to people on different sides of practically every issue was Obama's calling card from the time he was a college student, first at Occidental and then at Columbia, and it certainly continued in his 2 years as a community organizer in Chicago and then during his time at the Harvard Law School. Just a few months ago, he gave an address to the Illinois State Legislature. And in that address, he looked back at how much he learned as a legislator. But he pointed out that he was able in Illinois and in the U.S. Senate to do precisely what the Republicans prevented him from doing as president, and that is to come together with people who had different points of view and to shape bipartisan approaches to the problems that faced first Illinois and then the United States. So I think it is, I think you're absolutely right. I think that is who he has been, and it was striking to see just how much emphasis he placed on that in his farewell address. And I think he's absolutely right. That's what we need as a democracy, and that's what we seem to be lacking right now.
And again, I'm speaking with James Kloppenberg, who's the Charles Warren Professor of American History and the Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. His books include Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. And his latest book is Towards Democracy, the Struggle for Self-Rule in European and American Thought. Well, it's worth noting, though, that when he was inaugurated, and we have an inauguration coming up in less than a week, the very time, at the very moment that President Obama was being inaugurated back in 2009, you had a meeting of top Republicans, including Paul Ryan, Newt Gingrich and others, met, and they literally plotted to bring down his presidency. And the one thing that they all agreed on is that Obama wanted to be bipartisan and made quite an advertisement about bipartisanship. And that was one thing that they could take away from him. That was a defeat that they could hand him, and they did it.
I think that's exactly right. I think that the very self-conscious realization that he and his staff had going in is that they would succeed only if they managed to avoid the kind of backlash that many people predicted when the first African American was elected. And to the contrary, the Republicans did everything they could do, as did the right-wing press, to feed exactly that backlash. And I think you can see, as a result of the Affordable Care Act, that there was a concerted effort from the very beginning to paint it as something other than what it was. And to this day, Republicans describe it as a socialist takeover of healthcare, and it is anything but that. And yet, as I think your former guest was pointing out, we have entered a moment in history, and I hope it's only a brief moment, when reliance on accuracy and facts doesn't seem to be particularly appealing to a lot of people. And many people have made a lot of money because of their lack of respect for the facts and their willingness to feed the lowest and most hate-filled prejudices of the American people. And now that we have a president who has ridden precisely that kind of racism and that kind of animosity all the way to the White House, it's hard to see how that's going to be reversed. But I think if we don't reverse it, that basic sense of solidarity that Obama referred to in his farewell address is going to be even more and more precarious.
But is it possible that our culture has become so coarsened that there's an old expression, nice guys finish last? And in a way, Obama got punished because he was a nice guy. And his opponents interpreted his reaching out to them as a form of weakness.
Well, I think they did, and I think we don't know yet, and we won't know for a good long time, whether indeed he will be perceived as weak and temporizing, or whether he will be seen, as many people see him right now, as one of the most admirable figures to have held the presidency. So it's certain that his detractors, that his opponents view him that way, but I'm not sure that's how history is going to view him. A lot of it will have to do with what happens not just in the next 4 or 8 years, but what happens in the next 50 years. If the United States moves in the direction of some sort of national health care program, as it seems to me inevitable that we will, just as every other industrialized nation has done, then he's going to appear to be a pioneer who first took the steps in that direction. The same thing could be said about the Dodd-Frank Economic Regulation and the Consumer Protection Act. If the Republicans succeed in rolling back all of those achievements of the Obama presidency, then in the short run, he is going to appear to have failed. But history is long, and it's not at all clear that his legacy will be rolled back or that he will be seen as weak if the president-elect is defeated in 4 years, if he's replaced by a progressive Democrat. And when you look at the public opinion polls on most of the substantive issues, there does seem to be a majority, particularly among younger Americans, for many of the progressive programs that Obama was in favor of. If the Democratic Party manages to put together a stronger set of candidates, including presidential candidate, than it had this time, this could well look more like a blip than a reversal in the in the career of social democracy. But it's hard at this moment to see that as happening because it's such a glum moment. And as you said, the coarsening of the culture seems so striking that it's hard to see it moving back in the other direction. But let's not lose hope, as Obama himself encouraged us not to do at the end of the farewell address, that change has been real, things have been accomplished during his lifetime, and we simply have to make sure that we don't stop resisting the coarsening and keep moving in the direction of the ideals that he stands for.
Well, at the risk of being a killjoy, I'm all for hope. And by the way, the whole mantra of Obama's For Hope and Change was that we can do it. It was we, not I can do it. And one of the problems, I think, with American politics is, and particularly the presidency, where most people vote, particularly on the left, they tend to vote for, in the presidential elections and then leave the midterms for the Republicans to win. He didn't say, I can do it. And immediately progressives were disappointed that somehow he wasn't the miracle worker. And that still is a sort of vestige of you know, residual disappointment. But, you know, Thomas Jefferson warned that an ignorant people can never be a free people. And as our civic discourse gets coarse, and also I think our understanding of civics is more and more deficient and less emphasized. And what concerns a lot of people is the possibility that we do have an authoritarian leader. His press conference, the first press conference he had, resembles Vladimir Putin's press conferences, where Putin's insulting and basically chooses softball questions, and anybody that's stupid enough to ask him a tough question disappears or is never at the next press conference. So I'm not suggesting that we have that kind of country yet, but we could head in that direction. And the point about democracy is that unless people aren't sufficiently engaged, it can die.
Right, and that's exactly the point that Obama made toward the end of the farewell address, that what's necessary for people to do now is to engage and to rebuild those democratic institutions that are so crucial. I think it is true that the Democratic Party has assumed that it could place its emphasis primarily on national campaigns and let the local and state party mechanisms atrophy, and that has been a disaster for the Democratic Party. So I think that message became even clearer as a result of this election, but I think even before, the DNC was moving in the direction of realizing that they need to make up ground at the state level. And so I think there is going to be a redoubled effort in that direction, and we'll have to see whether the press has the fortitude to stand up to somebody who would like very much, I think, to be an authoritarian ruler who can order people around and intimidate people into doing his bidding. But that never has been the tradition of the press in the United States, and it seems to me it'll be interesting to see during the next 4 years to what extent he's able to get away with what he would like to do. There are going to be people in the press, certainly who are going to applaud that kind of swagger, but there are going to be plenty of people, including yourself and many other people on the left, who are going to shriek that this is antithetical to everything that American democracy stands for. And if I were a betting man, I'd put my money on the resistance rather than on the autocrat.
Well, I try to refrain myself from shrieking, but I think you've detected something there that is indeed happening. Alarm, I think, more than panic. Just in the last couple of minutes, James Kloppenburg, of course, Obama himself has been blamed for this tremendous bloodletting on the part of Democratic office holders across the country. I think 1,000 have lost their positions in both national and state legislatures since Obama's been president. Do you think that's an unfair charge?
I do. I think he's been blamed for almost everything that's gone wrong in the last 8 years. And I think, as you noted a few minutes ago, his point from the beginning is this is something only we can accomplish. And the Democratic electorate simply didn't mobilize in 2010 or in 2012 or in 2014. And certainly, but a majority in the presidential election, we can't forget that. But the fact that it didn't carry the Electoral College, I think, is again an indication of just how crucial local and state organizing remains and how little attention the Democratic Party, which, as my colleague Thea Scotchpole pointed out a while ago, has become a party of checkbook democracy rather than participatory democracy. And that has not worked. The Republican Party has done a better job of mobilizing people, and I'm not happy about the ways in which they succeeded in mobilizing people on what I see as often hate-filled agendas, but they succeeded in bringing out voters. And I think it is now up to the Democratic Party to mobilize those voters around a very different vision, which, again, I think actually a majority of Americans share. But if the opposition to Obama has shown us anything, it has shown us just how powerful racism remains as a force in America. If you look at the most salient criteria or characteristics of the people who were supporting Trump from the beginning and through the election, they were the inclination to believe that Obama was not born in the United States and the inclination to believe that he was a Muslim, both of which are factually false. And yet people are so deeply distrustful of African Americans in the United States that many of them are inclined to believe even what can be demonstrated to be false because it suits their racist convictions. So I do think that that's part of what the Democratic Party has to address again, and it will be hard to find a standard bearer for the program more appealing, more attractive, more persuasive than Barack Obama was. And given how little success he had in dislodging that tradition of racism in America, it's very hard, as you said, to feel much optimism. But I don't know what the alternative is. I think the alternative is despair, and that doesn't help us. In the aftermath of the election, I was reminded of Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist and former slave, who encountered throughout his life setbacks far more extreme than we have encountered in the most recent election, and refused to despair. And I think that's what we have to do.
Well, James Kloppenburg, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I'm speaking with James Kloppenburg, who's the Charles Warren Professor of American History and the Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. His books include Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. And his latest book is Towards Democracy, The Struggle for Self-Rule in European and American Thought. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.